Welcome to this episode of Anesthesia on Air. This is a podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. This podcast is the fifth in a series in which we look at the heritage of the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the history of anaesthesia. My name is Anna Maria Rollin. I'm a retired consultant anaesthetist and the current chair of the Heritage and Archives Committee of the College. In this episode, we will be looking at the power of observation, how our observational skills may have changed over generations of doctors, and how a trip to an art gallery can enhance those skills. I'm delighted to be joined today by Simon Chadwick, who is a retired consultant anaesthetist from Manchester, and by Sarah Ramsey, a current council member and a consultant anaesthetist working in Glasgow. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves.
Yeah, I'm Sarah Ramsey and I'm a consultant in anaesthesia and intensive care in Glasgow. I'm on the council. I'm currently chair of the finance board and I'm the college treasurer.
Simon Chadwick. I worked in North Manchester. I'm age 64 and I had to take early retirement at the age of 58 because I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
I think it's fair to say that Simon developed some new interests after he retired and Sarah's going to ask him about them.
Thank you, Maria. So, Simon, how did things work out for you after you retired? How did you get into this?
I ended up doing a part-time master's degree at Manchester University, which was in medical history and medical humanities. I understood what the history was about, but I hadn't really appreciated the humanities side of it. And that looks at how art and medicine are interrelated. And it looked very carefully at literature, poetry, the written word, and pictures and art in representation of illness and disease. And as part of the course, we got on to looking more carefully at the interpretation of illness. And within that, there was a lecture which was really interesting on how looking at art and interpreting art and written art could benefit doctors in training to develop their skills in observation. And it was a fascinating topic, and I started to look into it more.
So tell me about when you were training in medicine, how were you taught to observe?
We were taught to look at the patient, stand at the end of the bed, and just observe the patient, observe the clinical signs, and take it on board and try and describe as best as we could. And it is a skill that took some time to learn, and it's written about in MacLeod's Clinical Examination, which I think is a book that we all use.
Yeah, I had one of them as well.
And that describes the first part of the clinical examination, is to actually stand and observe the patient and look at the patient. And some people have argued that perhaps it's being less utilised now with all the other modern devices and techniques that are available to us.
I suppose it is true, though, that time moves on, so we're lucky that we've got the technology that we've got, but maybe perhaps we're losing sight a little bit of just taking the time to spend some time with the patient and see what we can see. Have you got any examples of where perhaps modern medicine's gone too fast?
I think we could all probably come up with personal examples, and I've got one in mind, but I came across two cases in the literature looking into this. And there was one by a chap called Abraham Verghese, who's a professor of humanities in medicine in Stanford, and he comes up with a case he saw where there was a lady kept coming back and forth to the hospital having multiple tests and investigations for shortness of breath, and nobody pulled the whole picture together until he uncovered the lady properly and examined her and discovered that she had a tumour in her breast, which had been missed because nobody had taken the time to actually observe the patient. And there's another case written up by Fabriella Fastinella, who again is another professor of family medicine and has a history in communication skills. And this was a patient who had been bouncing back and forth to various clinics with tiredness and fatigue, lots of investigations, some abnormalities, but they hadn't pulled it all together. And she actually spent some time looking at the patient, and she noticed that the skin was slightly hyperpigmented, looked into this a little bit more, and came up with the diagnosis from her observations that the patient had Addison's disease. So these are two examples where you can get lost in the myriad of technological investigations without looking at the patient. And I actually have a case, similarly, which I remember from when I was a house officer, came to mind. A young man in his late 30s kept coming back and forth to the A&E department at the Trafford Hospital where I was doing my first surgical job. And he'd been in several times and everyone was convinced that he was coming in asking for more pethidine. And when I looked at him, I could see he was in a lot of discomfort and a lot of pain. in his abdomen, and I examined him properly, looked at him, took a proper history. It struck me how much pain he was in, and I actually did an amylase that night, and it came back marginally abnormal. So I admitted him, and the next morning we sent him off for a CT scan, and unfortunately had a very advanced pancreatic tumour, which was beyond salvation. But this chap had been coming back and forth for several months to the A&E department. So that was a personal lesson that I learned, that just spend some time and look at the whole picture. Very salutary.
Very, very. Let's go back to the core. And did they go back right to the dawn of time?
We looked at the early Egyptians and how they practiced medicine, some of the writings from there, and then obviously moving on to the early Greeks, the days of Hippocrates, who is described as the father of medicine, and all the other physicians of the time. And they were great recorders and great observationalists. And some of those writings that have been found in great libraries of Alexandria have come down through history as classics. We then move to the period of Galen around the Romans, who was the next great physician. We have to remember that the physicians of these times, they didn't have all the diagnostic tools we had, and they didn't have the understanding of illness. All they had was the ability to write down and describe and observe and try and draw their own conclusions. So that's where we went back to the first stages of history and written history in medicine. Absolutely fascinating at the time.
I bet it was.
Really interesting.
Simon, may I take you back to what you said previously about the different view, obviously, that Hippocrates and Galen had of the causation of illness? For example, the four humours and the way they looked at illness then as opposed to the way we look at now. Could you expand a little bit on some of that?
There is the classic view that early illness, we have the four humours, blood, yellow bile, black bile and urine, which were the fluids that could be seen. And illness resulted in an imbalance between the humours. And this is where we got onto the concept of letting blood, let the bad blood out, and cupping. But they didn't have anything else to talk about, this concept of the imbalance, bodily humours.
I think you said that their observational powers were their main diagnostic tool. And then where did medicine go from there?
The next important step in medicine really was the advent of anatomical dissection in the 1500s. The grave robbers and the early anatomical schools of the time.
It's quite interesting how things move on, isn't it? That just started with simply being able to record, and we had ways of recording, there was writing, and there was ways to document for the future. And then as we moved on to the world of dissection and much more real life, gradually became much more scientific and
accurate anatomical drawing.
Anatomical.
Yeah, very accurate.
Very controversial with the church at the time, concept of dissecting bodies. We then moved to the 1600s when they started to classify disease and Sidemann and the phrase nosology of disease. And this was the descriptors and trying to put them all into categories. I think that was the next big phase in the development of medicine and description. Not much developed in our understanding of disease until we moved into the what they call the age of the clinic, or the development of the hospitals around the time of French Revolution. This was a period when, particularly across Europe, we had urbanisation beginning to develop and populations were moving more into city centres, and they realised that they had to develop places to look after the ill. Because prior to that, hospitals had been small places run by monasteries where people went to die, really. With the development of the hospitals, such as the Salpêtrière in Paris around the early 1800s. And medicine moved forward in this period, but they were still couldn't make any diagnoses and they didn't really have many treatments. We have the development of percussion, auscultation around this period, the descriptors of all those and historians.
There's definitely a parallel with what's happening with science across the board.
This is the age of enlightenment.
That description of the world people were living in and looking to categorise the world of nature and plants and animals in the same way we were looking to categorise medicine and understand it better. All these things happening in parallel, weren't they? So there was a bit of an overlap as well between the people that were leading in the forefront of medicine often had interest in other areas of science as well, didn't they?
They did, and two of the essays I want to discuss by James Parkinson and James Paget, they both had other interests. Parkinson was a great fossilist of his time, a naturalist. And he's actually, to some extent, more famous for his works on fossils. And he's got several fossils named after himself. And Paget wrote a book at the time with his brother on the botany and flora of Great Yarmouth, where he grew up. And he goes back to that and describes how that early book taught him the skills he used later on in his medical career. So these people, they were more gentlemen scientists at the time rather than just physicians. And there are all that era of the, you know, the enlightened sciences, the early development of classification botanists. So it was a great period of moving forward in terms of science and understanding of the world.
So tell me a bit more about these essays. I have an idea of, you know, 2,000 word essay, and I presume these are much more a book form of essay. Are they readable today? Would I find that I could dig into it and learn from it today?
Well, the reason I brought them up comes back to this topic we started out, which is talking about the ability to observe and record your observations. There were a lot of people at the time who wrote about describing illness, but I think I've picked these two out as two of the classic essays of their time. And the essay by James Parkinson, an essay on the shaking palsy, he describes six cases very eruditely and descriptively, and it is worth reading them. They are very readable. The language is a little bit archaic by modern standards, but when you read through them, what it does do is it gives you that ability to understand how to interpret and record disease. And James Paget, similarly, his essay, which he read out and to the Royal Society in the 1870s, is very readable today. And I think the modern student would gain a lot by sitting down and reading them and learning how to write with clarity about what you see and understand. So I think there is a lot in there to think through.
Can I just confirm with you, just for my own education, that these papers you're referring to, the essays, Parkinson's and Paget's, are describing the diseases which are named after them?
The eponymous diseases, yes.
Yes, I was just needing to check that, really.
Yes, they are acknowledged as that, and they are recognised as two of the great people. And I would recommend that people do actually print them off and read them. I've actually got a copy of a transcript, but it was a reprint from the 1900s.
I'm just going to go a little bit into that time you were talking about, when the hospitals were developing and medicine was becoming much more of a science, and drawing interested people in. And I have an image of the beginning of the theatre, the operating theatre, and lots of very keen people wanting to come and learn medicine. Did you hear much about that time and becoming in sort of the birth of the modern doctor?
Yes, it's the age of the clinic and the age of hospital. The early anatomists would have great banks of students watching, and it was a form of entertainment coming to watch these in the universities, almost like the Roman amphitheatre. And the very early operating theatres were like that. I think we were all aware of the picture of the first anaesthetic in the Ether Dome, which is on our college website. If you look at that, it's like an amphitheatre with the terraced stage in the background and all the students in their frock coats hearing down. So I think it is an image that we have to bear in mind.
I can remember at my medical school there was some of the lecture theatres which were steeply banked around the stage, and the poor patients would be tripped on and for the clinical lectures and be demonstrated to us. So things don't change that much over time. And even when I started my first surgical house job, we had an operating theatre that still had a gallery around the top of the operating theatre, reminiscent of those times when people would come and watch. If I want to find out something now, how to do something, I'm probably going to YouTube it. But in those days, you had to see something to understand what it meant and perhaps what an operation entailed. To actually see it in the flesh, it was very helpful, very impactful. It helped you learn. And the only way to do that was to be there and to be as part in the operating theatre watching.
Yes, and some of the reconstructed theatres around the world have got these recreated. But on the basis of the banks, I remember as a medical student, I graduated in 1983, so it's not that long ago, the Skin Hospital in the centre of Manchester, opposite the Albert Hall, the outpatients had a bank of 12 seats behind the consultant terrace where the tutorial group of students sat, and the patient came in and was stripped off in front of this bank of students. So it's not that long ago. And the poor patients, what they must have felt like.
I think that's an extrapolation, in fact, because my recollection, which goes back even further than yours, is that many of the patients then regarded themselves as part of the training program. I trained at Guy's, which had a very close-knit community around it, Cockney community. And certainly the patients who came in felt that it was their duty to train the medical students. And if they saw something interesting or were told something interesting, they would call us over and say, have you seen this? So it wasn't the modern idea of absolute patient privacy. It's quite new.
Well, I remember when I did my anaesthetic exam on Gower Street for the primary, they had regular patients come in and they had been to several exams. They were almost these professional patients with long-standing stable signs. And I remember my patient, when I picked up the peak flow, he said to me, you're the first one this morning who's actually done that. Well done, you'll pass.
I can remember somebody who had pulmonary fibrosis, and I asked the simple question of, well, what's brought you into hospital today? And the patient said, well, that's for me to know and you to find out. Yeah. So as we're moving forward in time, one thing that strikes me is technology is not a new thing. It's always been happening in the same way that the first stethoscopes allowed us to start auscultating. We were getting better at recording imagery. We were being able to record pictures in books and distribute books, and then we went into photography, and that must have been a really big shift in medical training when you could actually start taking pictures of stuff and then move away from relying on somebody to paint something to actually seeing an objective image of it. Did you cover that in your course much?
We did a little bit, because obviously the modern art is photography, and there are aspects where people are photographing patients and you can use photographs as an interpretation and recording. It wasn't covered quite as much, because I think they put the emphasis more on aspects of art and traditional art and the interpretation of how artists are often innocently, without knowing about it, caught illness. They were the cameras of the modern day, in that they redrew exactly what they saw, often without knowing about it, and they accurately drew the pictures. So that would be the equivalent of the photograph of its day, whereas a photograph, of course, does capture everything. It's how the person looking at the picture, whether it be a photograph or a painting, stands and interprets what they see and uses that visual acuity to interpret the development of and describe what they see and try and communicate that picture to another person.
I was interested in what you mentioned there about accidentally capturing illness. Have you got any favourite examples of illness in painting?
There are lots of examples that we can look at. I think one, which is very much as a classic, is the picture of Bathsheba at her bar, where the artist Rembrandt, it was his mistress he's painted, and he's trying to create the biblical scene of Bathsheba being bathed with somebody bathing her feet. She's sat on the bed, she's naked, and what he has captured is this slightly melancholic looking lady with a shadowing on her left breast and a slight fullness in the axilla, which represents what we now know would have been a breast tumour. It's not sure whether he intended to depict that, but it's quite likely he actually observed himself that there would have been asymmetry in her breasts. And in one of the papers I read about this, somebody has actually said perhaps her melancholy look is that she herself knows that there is something wrong in her breasts. And it's not unlikely that people would have realised that these were tumours, and she may well have known her own diagnosis. But that is one of the classics of how illness has been caught in a picture. And there are other examples that we can talk through. We've got a picture which is called The Three Graces, which was painted by Rubens in 1639. And this is a picture of three sisters who are in a state of undress, to put it politely.
Very polite, Simon.
One is his wife and her two sisters. And he probably didn't realise he was painting these clinical signs, but a rheumatologist, De Quecker, has actually described what he calls the classic hypermobility syndrome. And if you look at these pictures, the lady in the centre has got scoliosis of her spine, and you can see her pelvis is clearly tilted with a Trendelenburg sign, the positive Trendelenburg. And the lady on the left is showing that she's got classic flat feet and hyperextension in her fingers in her right hand. The fourth and fifth joints are actually looking double jointed. And all three graces seem to have lax spinal lordosis and upper double jointedness. Now, we know that these signs weren't accidentally painted by him, because in other pictures he's reproduced the same clinical signs. But before he married his second wife and started painting the sister, other nude models he's used don't demonstrate these interpretations of the hypermobility syndrome.
So that's not just how he painted people. This was something in his models.
It is the artist capturing with his own visual aspects.
Another thing I suppose has changed is that diseases, obviously as we're getting better with treating diseases, the physical signs of diseases are less obvious. I'm thinking back to when I was training and looking at classic rheumatoid hands, as they were called, and now with advances in modern treatment, it's much, much less common. The science of understanding medicine was first, and the treatment of diseases only came much, much later.
Yeah, and we've got another classic painting which comes back to the description of Paget's disease, a painting by Matisse, which has been described as the Old Woman or the Ugly Duchess, which is an absolute classic painting from about 1513, which is almost a caricature in itself of a portrait. But if you look at this lady, he's caught many of the features of Paget's disease. She's got this sort of specific facial exaggerated ugliness with deformation, the bossed forehead, the very prominent cheekbones, and the extended distance of her maxilla between her upper lip and her nose, and the slightly rictus smile that goes with that. It's a very striking picture, and the artist has clearly caught these, and there's some changes in her hands as well. Difficult to describe orally what you're looking at, but it's an absolute caricature of ugliness, and many people have got this picture.
I had her pinned to my pin board when I was at medical school. I love her. I'm glad she's not pretty and gorgeous and rounded and she's buxom, but you know, she's just nice to see, or good to see, representation of real life rather than perfect or bucolic life. I've always loved her quite a lot, actually.
The classic term is Rubenesque, that a lot of the portraits reflected that these ladies were slightly fuller than perhaps the modern models who looked like bean poles. So that is catching real life.
I suppose it was of its time. To be well nourished was a sign of affluence, and nowadays it's probably switched around. So thinking on to anaesthesia and observing, so thinking about the modern world, I find we're beset with information. We've got phones which have got access to everything you could imagine, and images and information, and I can ask ChatGPT or Copilot to do things for me. And artificial intelligence is popping up everywhere. How do we take time to slow down, just look, and not just look, observe? How can we do that?
I think you have to purposely learn to stand back a little bit. I was taught the phrase, the golden minute. When you're looking at a patient, take a minute to stand at the end of the bed and just look and absorb the whole scene in front of you. The patient, the bed, the locker, the relative if they're sat there. And it's almost called the golden minute of silence. And another way you gain time, when I was doing my pre-op assessment clinic, the way the clinic was laid out, there was a corridor to the waiting room, and I used to take the bottom room, call the patient down, and I would watch them walk down the corridor without saying anything, come into the room, sit down. And again, with their relative, was the relative fussing over them? How were they dressed? What was their gait? Could they undress? All these subtle signs without saying anything. And there are several articles that have been written about this, which brings us back to the definition of observare, the Latin, to observe, to watch, to guard, all different interpretations. And I think it is just taking that time rather than leaping into the immediate technology. And it's valuable time that can gain you useful information. Slow down.
Slow down in a world which is going past us at breakneck speed.
Festina lente, more haste, less speed.
Sometimes it does feel hard to just take that moment, because when you do take a moment, people try and fill that moment. I find sometimes on a ward round, I do just want to step back and assimilate everything that's happening. The mood in the room and what the patient looks like and what the vibe of the team is, and then all the individual little pieces of information from the monitor and the pumps and computer. But the world hardly lets you do that. Somebody always then has to interrupt that moment and fill the gap. And I love going to an art gallery and just wandering round and just taking some time to sit and, or just stand at a painting, take it all in, go up close and look at the brush strokes, step away back and see what it looks like in the bigger picture. And some interesting things I think you found out in your course about the overlap between looking at art that way and medical training.
Yes, quite a few medical schools now have come on board with this concept of actually using art to teach students how to step back and describe and just spend a little bit of time reflecting. And they have purposely bought into their training and their communication courses, particularly taking the students to art courses and spending some time and just choosing paintings and getting them to describe the paintings and what they actually see, and reflecting on what they see and writing shutting it down, almost trying to get the purpose to slow down. And there have been some observational studies where they've actually looked at this, and they have been able to show conclusively that when they give students clinical pictures with photographs of conditions and ask them to score the clinical interpretations, those students who have been taken away and done these constructive courses of criticising art do actually score better on the interpretation of the clinical photographs. So there is some evidence to prove that this is of benefit to interpreting your observational skills. And I think there is merit in that. And I was reading that the specialty of radiology, which is looking at images particularly, radiologists in training have taken this on board, and they've started being taken to art galleries and using the technique of looking at paintings and describing paintings and transferring those skills into their interpretation of staring at computer screens in a dark room. So it has got implications and uses as an idea.
Can I ask, we're moving ever further from direct observation because of COVID, and partly as a result, and partly now as a drive for efficiency. The remote consultation, sometimes video consultation, which is being used by many, many GP practices, certainly, where patients are not observed except in a way in which they wish to be observed. Makeup, filters, presenting yourself. How's that going to influence the practice of medicine, the observational powers of the physician, the fact that the patient lights and makes up their own faces?
I think we've all sat staring at screens. I actually missed COVID. I'd retired by then, so obviously it wasn't quite part of my experience. But we all know that when you're looking at somebody on a Zoom meeting, it's some of those soft signs that don't come across as well. So I think that is a risk that we have to bear in mind. And I think telemedicine has got advantages, but I think we have to take on board that it has limitations as well. So I think we have to be a little bit cautious. And there are the odd anecdote where people say things were missed. You might not be able to see the whole picture. I was taught to look at the patient's shoes, because it can actually tell you quite a lot. Are they dirty? Are they scuffed? Are there little white deposits of glycosuria? Do you remember being taught that at medical school? You'd miss that. So it's those subtle things that perhaps don't get picked up. And that comes back to the observational skills. You know, are the patient's clothes clean? Do they look baggy? Has the patient lost weight? Again, you can pick that up by observation. Coming back to that silent minute where you just look at the picture around you. And patients at the end of the bed, and what's around them on the bedside locker in terms of their food and everything.
Yeah, I do that with medical students. Obviously, intensive care is a little bit of an overwhelming environment for many people. And for a new student coming into that environment, it's quite a lot to take in. So I just ask them to start by describing what they can see around the patient's bed space. And then I ask them to go and line themselves up so that they would be seeing things from the patient's perspective. So instead of looking at the patient, go and stand and look up from where the patient is. What can the patient see? I think that's another very interesting part of observing, is it helps you to get your mind into the patient's mind a little bit better. It's less just, oh, this is a chest infection. This is a chest infection with somebody who's frail or worried, or, you know, you start to understand a little bit more about the patient and how they're feeling about their illness. And I think that's a very important part of modern education, medical education, is to make sure that we do have the power of communication as well, and asking the students to look up from where the patient is. What can the patient see? Often they can't see very much. They can maybe see a clock, but they probably haven't got their glasses on. They can't see a window, can't see natural daylight. I think that's another part of observing the whole thing, is not just the professional medical side, but actually patient side. And I think that's something that's missing in all the remote sides and the remote communication. I think patients are missing out on something too. We are missing out on being able to see our patients, but I think the patients are missing out on being able to see their doctor, and there's possibly times when there's something they might have been able to get into a conversation about that they feel they can't on a 10-minute consultation, which is going to end very soon.
And I think also, when you're observing the intensive care scenario, don't forget the relatives sitting there. I actually did a piece from the course called The Vigil, which was about describing the patient's relatives sat there at 3 o'clock in the morning with this new admission, absolutely scared into rigidity in this totally alien environment. They can't touch or communicate with their loved one, all the monitors and paraphernalia. And looking after the relatives is as important, observing how they might be feeling in this alien environment. So I think, again, comes back to the observation skills. And bringing it back to the level of humanity, medicine is a human subject. We are looking after our fellow human being, and we have to remember that and not lose it in the technology.
So Simon, we've got two pictures in front of us, and I'll just quickly describe them, because obviously we can't show them. We've got one of a very, very busy bed space in critical care. I think it was probably taken during the COVID pandemic, and there is every piece of kit under the sun you can think about. I think the patient's on ECMO, they're on the filter, there's a bank of flashing lights, patient in the bed in the middle of it all. We've also got a picture of a painting from the 1930s of a lady lying in her bed. She's also a patient and a person who's not well, but they're very, very different. How do you compare and contrast them, Simon?
I think focusing on the patient aspects of these, the modern intensive care picture is a photograph trying to give us an image of a bed space, the perspective of somebody coming in to observe and absorb what's happening. As you described, there's an awful lot of equipment around. The bed space looks chaotic. The sheets are all rumpled up underneath. We can see the bare mattress. It's not neat. It's all very dishevelled. There's a green drape thrown across the top of where the patient is. You can't actually see the patient at all. This space they're under is though at the centre of this image. And I think that conveys to me the scene of slight chaos. And we've lost that there's a human in the midst of all of this. We've got drip stands, we've got pumps, we've got flashing lights, as you say. A very expensive ITU bed with its own monitors on. And we'd walk in and we'd try and absorb all this information quite quickly. Maybe without even realising that there is still a patient in the midst of all of this. But we have to observe all this and with visual literacy accumulate all the information being thrown at us. And there is so much to absorb very rapidly. Gain a knowledge of what the clinical scenario that we have here. So I think this is an important image of modern medicine and how it has been portrayed in the modern picture, which isn't an artist painting the picture, but somebody using a camera, the modern picture painting. Whereas if we move to a painting by Peter Urich, which was painted in the mid-1930s and is in the Southampton Gallery, this is a lady called Mrs. Green who actually asked the patient's mother if she could get her son to come and paint it. She's been sent home from the sanatorium. This is a very different picture. It shows a lady sat semi-recumbent, propped up on pillows. The blankets are very neatly folded, very clean. She's wearing a pretty yellow nightgown. She's got her pearls around her neck. She's even got some rouge with her makeup on her cheeks. The window's open. There's some fresh flowers on the windowsill. And there's a little painting on the wall behind her. A very calm scenario. But when you come to look at the lady, you can observe she's lost a lot of weight. She looks cachectic. You can see the strap muscles in her neck standing out. Her hands are resting on her tummy, folded neatly on her bed. And if you look at the way the artist has captured her hands, they actually look slightly mottled, bluey, and her fingers are painted slightly blue, which probably represents cyanosis. Her eyes are slightly gaunt and staring, and I think he has captured a very different image, almost a peaceful and restful image. Clearly, this is a representation of a lady who's in the last few days of her life. And it's a very powerful image that I think if you just stand and observe and try and describe, you get a feeling for what the scenario is here. And it is almost one of peace, but it's an important image to try and capture. We're trying to, in these two pictures, convey two very different scenes. Patients who both may be at the ends of their lives. The ICU patient is clearly very unwell and may well not come through this. But this patient is surrounded by a host of modern technology that we have to take on board. Whereas the picture from the 1930s, none of this modern technology would have been available. But I think the artist has captured the scene at the end of her life very succinctly, and I think it is worth reflecting on. And the way and the visual literacy of both scenes is important.
Yeah, I think they're two very, very impactful pictures. And it's true that the patient is still at the centre of the photograph of the critical care unit. You can't see their face, whereas the other painting is all about the person lying in the bed. And it's great that we have the advances we've had in modern technology. And it's impacted on the time that we have to be able to take time to observe and to assimilate information. So much information that we have now that we didn't have before, so much technology. But comparing the two, the patient still at the centre of both, it is important to remember that at the heart of it all is a human being, somebody suffering, and that taking time to just think about them and to see them and to see them as a human being is something that we must never lose sight of.
You've taken us from Hippocrates to the COVID pandemic, which was quite a bumpy ride. You've done a very good job. So thank you both, Simon and Sarah, very much indeed.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
The RCOA warmly welcomes members from across the globe. So if you're based outside of the UK, we invite you to discover the array of benefits available to you as an RCOA international affiliate. To learn more about joining and to explore the benefits of membership, visit rcoa.ac.uk/international-affiliate or click on the link in the show notes.